On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a whole
Terror struck at Istanbul's airport, and there's a threat of more ISIS attacks in Turkey. The Supreme Court struck down abortion restrictions, and Europe continues to struggle with next steps on Brexit. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate. And our special guest is Juliet Kayyem, lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and author of the book Security Mom. Welcome to you all. The terror attack at Istanbul's Atatürk Airport on Tuesday now has a death toll of 44. Three suicide bombers used guns and bombs to kill at the airport, and it's increasingly clear this attack was not just inspired by ISIS, but planned by it. Juliet, I know there have been warnings about several dozen ISIS fighters entering Turkey with the intent of carrying out attacks. Should we worry that there's more to come?
I think we should anticipate more attacks, in particular in Turkey, which has allowed its borders to be porous for some time and so now is going to unfortunately see the consequences of that. And I think what that means for counterterrorism efforts is a couple of issues. One is, in this case and in every case, people around the terrorist network knew something was fishy going on. As we're starting to see in Turkey, neighbors are now disclosing, that they smelled things coming from the apartment that the men had kept to themselves. So I think there has to be a sort of a much greater commitment to community engagement in all of these countries, including our own. I think the second issue is more important, which is just we have to just accept this idea that soft targets are soft because we want them to be, rather than because we've neglected security. Airports are a perfect example. You know, they're soft because they have to maximize flow in a global economy where we want to see people move commerce, move goods, all sorts of things. And you're really never going to get the vulnerability to zero. What you can do is invest in layered security and try to minimize the risk to populations. But this mythology that if only we put more resources in places like an airport or if we even move the security line, 10 miles away or wherever you're going to move it, you're still going to have a problem at mile 10.01. So I think lots to learn from what happened in Turkey, both for ourselves, but obviously for the attacks that are likely to come.
One of the things that's been mystifying to me watching the rise of ISIS over the last few years and then the ongoing fight that there's been with it is that the Turks were not being very helpful, which seemed weird to me. I mean, I understand they have their own interests in the region. They were not fans of the Assad regime in Syria. But it seemed like there was a risk that if you let ISIS fester, that was going to be a much bigger problem for Turkey than for us. Why didn't they foresee this? And is there going to be a change in the way the Turks behave in the future now that they know that this is a huge problem?
Yeah, and you saw the change actually after the Ankara attacks. So part of it is sort of the same thing that you actually saw with Brussels. I mean, those of us in counterterrorism knew that some European countries were sort of more than happy to have these guys go abroad, and they never sort of thought long term that they might actually come back, right, and harm their own citizens. And I think Turkey just did in many ways just sort of thought, if we can just sort of juggle long enough, maybe nothing bad will happen. And that's just obviously not true. But I will, in defense of Turkey, which certainly has a lot of problems, In the last year, they not only have tried to tighten up the borders, but they have certainly put sort of, you know, protective measures throughout Ankara and Istanbul. And that is what is so shocking about this airport attack is those of us who have traveled to this airport know it is not a warm and fuzzy experience. It is a heavily fortified, lots of very, very public displays of artillery. These three guys, plus whoever supported them, certainly did several drive-bys or you know, trial runs to maximize as many deaths as they could.
Rich, what do you make of this in terms of where to go from here? Because it feels to me like even if you think we should have acted earlier to disrupt ISIS in Iraq and Syria, maybe that we shouldn't have ever pulled our troops out of Iraq, it seems like the situation now is that if the, you know, if we continue to weaken their position in Iraq and Syria, that'll be good for the condition in Iraq and Syria, but it could actually lead to more attacks like this as you get a sort of ISIS diaspora with people returning to their home countries. What do you see as the key priorities to prevent more attacks like this?
Well, I think there's no alternative but to try to destroy the so-called caliphate, and we're making progress on that score slowly but perhaps surely. And the problem here is that Turkey really looks at Syria, which is a big source of this problem, obviously, and a big problem with for Turkey because it has a cataclysm unspooling on its doorstep, is the Turks really hate Assad and they want him to go. And we don't so much. We say that's our policy, but it's we have no interest in actually following through on that. And we support the Kurdish fighters within Syria as the most effective on-the-ground force that we have. And the Turks, for historic reasons, hate and loathe the Kurds, who they consider a threat to the integrity of sovereign Turkish territory. So there have actually been instances of the Turks bombing the Kurdish fighters that we support. So I'm not sure, even if Turkey takes the ISIS threat more seriously after this horrific attack, and even if it tilts more towards a policy that we would want it to, I'm not sure really you can square those circles.
Dalia, what do you worry about when you look at this?
It seems to me that what I keep hearing, and look, this is all that's left to do, you know, as ISIS loses territory and influence, what's left to do is these one-off horrific, admittedly horrific, terror attacks, but that in the grand scheme of things, this is the death rattle of an entity that is losing, and losing fast and losing hard, and that, you know, there's a limit to what we can do if, you know, nihilistic bombers can be activated from remote distances. That's what it is, and that can be dealt with to some degree, but that this is not a sign of something horrific happened. This is the sign of something that is dying.
What do you make of that, Juliet?
I think that's absolutely true. Geography matters to ISIS, not simply because then they can say, oh, we're in Iraq or we're in Syria. I mean, it's actually how they train. It's how they get money. You know, they tax the populations. They steal it. They hoard it. It's where recruits from around the globe come to. So the more that we are, the more that many countries are successful in limiting their geographic reach, it actually will have a tremendous influence in their capacity to recruit, because that's all it is for ISIS right now, is it's can it keep its numbers big enough to defend its land and also to launch, as Dalia was saying, these one-offs. And we're putting the ISIS-inspired attack sort of to the aside, because those are going to happen periodically, as we saw in some measure in Orlando. So I do think that our success geographically, or at least in terms of curbing their geographic weight, will have good consequences if we can just take the long view, which is you deplete a terrorist organization, you're not going to end, you know, radical Islam in the near future, but you can certainly deplete its capacity for recruitment. And that's all that matters right now. But unfortunately, the consequence is things like Istanbul and elsewhere. And, you know, part of it is us becoming more resilient, better at law enforcement and better at response capabilities. And kudos to, you know, the Turkish airport law enforcement. They did save a lot of lives by clearing out, at least on that second bomb, the pictures that we saw, clearing out that area to protect people, knowing that this was a suicide bomber. And, you know, whether the American public can accept that, I don't know. I do worry that, you know, you know, Orlando did not have a sort of dramatic, you know, political consequences. You know, Turkey seems far away. I do sort of worry in the months ahead whether, you know, cumulative attacks over time do make the American public more nervous than they should be, actually.
How much should we think of this in terms of the war of ideas? Because we look at what happened in Turkey and we talk about, you know, what are effective policing and counterterrorism measures to prevent people who would like to carry out these sorts of attacks from doing so? What are the things we can do militarily to weaken ISIS in Iraq and Syria? Is there an effective strategy for just causing fewer people in the world to think that it is a good idea to commit terror attacks in the name of Islam?
Yes, you kill them. I mean, I hate to sound so crude, but I don't think the West is going to be very good with a counter narrative to what Islam is, and I think that's within the religion itself. But what I do think we can be good at, and it's no surprise that Iraq released the pictures of them bombing the bejesus out of, you know, however many ISIS fighters were trying to flee Fallujah the other night, is that the counter narrative is ISIS is deadly. You will die if you join it. There is not, it's not, and, you know, women who join ISIS, you know, think that they're going to have Rolls Royces and a nice life. I think it's our counter narrative is you will die or be imprisoned. And that's, you know, that's an important counter narrative because, as I said, it's about recruitment. The bigger ideology is a long-term struggle within the religion itself. I call it radical Islam. It's what it is. But I don't think the West has a very good narrative or should not be responsible for that narrative itself.
Rich, what do you make of that? Because I feel like we hear versions of the counter-narrative from both the right and the left. From the left, you hear, you know, this isn't true Islam. True Islam stands in opposition to this. We need to draw distinctions between the two. From the right, you hear about the importance of talking about radical Islam by its name and standing up to it. And it's sort of, you know, from what Juliet's saying, it sounds like sort of both of those ideas are wanting in terms of convincing anybody.
Yeah, I don't think the people who really matter are listening to either side in our political debate talk about this. The centers of authority who have really credibility are within the Muslim world. So I agree entirely with Juliet. We need to do what we can to shrink their territory and kill as many extremists as we reasonably can, and then hope over the long term the battle of ideas is won within Islam, which is the only way it can be won. And one point back on domestic security, you know, President Obama has said, it was all over the famous Jeffrey Goldberg piece in The Atlantic about his worldview, that ISIS isn't an existential threat, and these, you know, attacks, they're nothing like the Soviets could have done to us with their nuclear arsenal during the Cold War, which is all true. But I think he underestimates the effect it'll have on our society if these attacks become routine, if there's one every 6 months or so. You'll end up having, you know, armed guards outside every significant gathering and big restaurant and bar in America. And that's something we really want to avoid if we can.
Let us know what you think about the Istanbul attacks at kcrw.com/LRC, our Facebook page, or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, the Supreme Court strikes down abortion restrictions. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Dahlia Lithwick of Slate and Juliet Kayyem, author of the book Security Mom and former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, is also with us. So in a 5-3 decision, the Supreme Court struck down a Texas law that imposed restrictions on abortion clinics. And the effect of this law had been to put clinics outside of major metropolitan areas like Dallas and Houston out of business. Dahlia, can you talk a little bit about what the reasoning was in the decision? Because certain abortion restrictions are constitutional. Why did the court say these restrictions couldn't be imposed?
Josh, the two that were at issue in this particular case, Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt had to do with, one, admitting privileges that required that any physician who performs abortions has to have admitting privileges in local hospitals. The other had to do with the need to retrofit clinics, any clinic that performs abortions, as what's called an ambulatory surgical center. What that means is that even in clinics where you're just doing a medicine abortion, even if abortion itself is not really surgery, you have to do these multi-million dollar retrofitting projects that would have had the effect of putting what at the time were 41 clinics when this first passed, became 19 clinics when it went into effect, and we would have been down to 8 or 9 clinics in Texas if the court had upheld it. So the reason that the court really, I think, by a 5-3 margin said, you know what, these are not permissible restrictions. This does not pass the undue burden test, and that was the SNF test from the 1992 Casey decision, where Sandra Day O'Connor kind of invented this test with the help of Anthony Kennedy and David Souter and said, you know, yes, the states can regulate abortion. They cannot place an undue burden on a woman's right to access reproductive care, but nobody knew what that meant. And what it meant around the country was a lot of these types of restrictions were being passed. The court really, for the first time, in an opinion written by Stephen Breyer, said, you know what? This doesn't match what the state says it's purporting to do, which is protecting women's health by having these two seemingly reasonable sounding regulations, doesn't map onto what is happening. A, we don't need them. B, they're not making women healthier. They're, in fact, imperiling women. And C, we think it's kind of crazy that we're regulating abortions this way, but not colonoscopies and liposuctions and other surgical procedures that have greater risks and are not regulated. So really what the court did was pierce the argument that anything that is done by the state that is said to be to promote the health of women is untouchable by the courts. It is emphatically the role of the courts, says Stephen Breyer, to look at why the legislature is doing that. And if, according to all the testimony that they reviewed, if these regulations are making women less safe and less healthy, they can be struck down.
Rich, does anyone really believe that these restrictions weren't pretextual? I mean, I look at this and I see lawmakers who profess a sincere objection to abortion passing legislation with the objective of discouraging and reducing abortion. Isn't that what happened in Texas?
Well, I think it can be both. It can be both that if we're going to have abortion clinics, you want them to be better and safer and more medically sophisticated abortion clinics, and two, at the same time, you want to reduce abortion. And this is a perfect case for a Democratic debate over whether this is the correct policy or not. But the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in this area is a complete mess. First of all, it created out of whole cloth a constitutional right to abortion, and usually both sides can agree when they're constitutional rights because they actually appear in the text of the Constitution. This right was completely invented by the Supreme Court. And then the undue burden standard, as Dahlia correctly points out, no one knew what it was or is because it's basically what Anthony Kennedy thinks on any given day about any given issue. So the Supreme Court would have legislated differently in this regard. That's fine, but again, it's something we can have a Democratic argument about. And if the people of Texas agree this is pretextual and a horrible thing, that one effect of it is reducing the number of abortion clinics, well, then they can reverse it. But it's not up for the five justices on the Supreme Court to apply their legislative will.
Oh, I mean, I think I would just add, you know, while I agree with the opinion, the thing I appreciated as being a former practicing lawyer is the extent to which the court in 5-3 really did try to speak in English. I think when you read this case, people who are invested in this debate, who are not lawyers, but young women who are, you know, entering, you know, these issues and others can actually finally at long last read a case that is understandable and fact-based. And I think that's something that the Supreme Court has been lacking a lot in their jurisprudence lately.
Dahlia Lithwick, Does this opinion mean a lot for what you think we're likely to see going forward from the court? I know there were a few other cases that had risen to the court that they decided this week not to take up, in which they could have allowed further restrictions on abortion or contraception. Does this signal a shift?
What we're seeing is an unambiguous statement from the Supreme Court that a lot of these so-called TRAP laws, that stands for Targeted Regulation of Abortion Providers, and these are laws that don't make the point that Rich was making, right, that abortion is wrong, that this is taking life, but that do the kinds of things that say, widen your hallways, have a 72-hour waiting period, you know, have all these, mandatory scripts that physicians read that warn women of medically not true connections between abortion and breast cancer, for instance. All of those laws are now really in question. And so what you're going to see, I think, especially with a shift by some of the reproductive rights groups who are really going to go on the offensive now for the first time in years, I think you're going to see a lot of those laws crumble. And I think you're going to see a shift on the part of the pro-life groups who are going to start pushing hard for heartbeat bans and other kinds of regulations that don't go to this issue of we need to help women make better decisions, we need to make clinics safer, and go right to the heart of what this debate, as Rich points out, could be about and legislatively might be about, which is when does life begin and how do we feel about that as a legislature?
I want to get to one more topic today. Britain has been making America's politics look downright functional over the last week. In the wake of the vote to Brexit, Prime Minister David Cameron has announced his resignation. The race to replace him has been filled with House of Cards-style intrigue. And in the opposition Labour Party, their leader, Jeremy Corbyn, won't go even though over 80% of his party's Member of Parliament voted to urge him to do so. Campaigners for leaving the EU have been admitting that many of the promises they made might not be kept when Britain is out. And the leading Conservative candidates to be Prime Minister replacing Cameron have been saying they won't start the two-year exit process for many months, meaning the fate of Britain and Europe may be unknown into 2019. And yet, the markets have been quite calm this week, and we've seen significant rebounds. So how nervous are we a week on? I know, Rich, you were taking the position last week that people should stop freaking out. Do you feel vindicated?
Well, I thought a lot of it was just based on panic, and that the panic passed. Now, it doesn't mean they're not serious issues and serious risks here. Wouldn't surprise me at all if Britain suffered at least a mild recession just on the basis of the uncertainty that's been created by this. And there's no doubt there's a lot of uncertainty. And it was in part because the leaders of Brexit themselves didn't really expect to win. So now you're going to have a big debate within the Tory party about what Brexit really means. You know, will Britain continue to be part of the single market? Should it continue to be part of the single market, even if it means continuing to accept open immigration from Europe? You know, these are all big questions that need to be decided. And I still think this, although it's messy and chaotic, as democracy often is the right way to go about it. You put before the people the big constitutional fundamental issue, should you be in or out? And then you have the parties and the representatives argue about how you actually do that.
I've been reflecting on this a little, and I have a fairly strong opinion. I think that they should have voted to remain, but I think it's a little weird how many Americans, including me, have strong opinions about this, especially because, you know, I wouldn't vote for a political union with Canada and Mexico. And I don't know, Dahlia, do you think that we're sticking our nose in this too much?
Well, I think it's interesting to us chiefly because it seems to mirror back some of the anxieties we're having in our 2016 presidential campaign. In other words, I think we have to disaggregate how involved we are in questions about the euro and the EU and sovereignty and the economy there from the way that this looks like it's an awfully familiar conversation that surprisingly in ways that I think Donald Trump has captured really binds together our own anxieties in this country about, you know, economic disenfranchisement, about immigration and what that means, about these questions of sovereignty and, you know, what Donald Trump would call making America great again, and who are these people that are taking that away. So it seems to me, I think, you know, part of it is, of course, you know, this has an impact on our economy and this has an impact on a lot of things American. But it seems to me more than anything that this looks like a lens into which we can make sense of an election that we have not been able to make sense of. And I think that it really dovetails with these big themes that we are very anxious about in this country. And it, in a way, gives us a way to talk about how did this happen? How are these unexpected things happening? And what do they signal about what's going to happen in November?
Julia, what do you think this means for us and Europe? And should we worry about the geopolitical fallout of this beyond what it will do for the economy of the UK and continental Europe?
No, I'm glad you asked that because, you know, the focus is on the economic impact or even immigration, but obviously it is going to have geopolitical impact. You know, as the center guest, you know, anything as disruptive as Brexit, I find, you know, I get anxious about it. It just seems like, you know, too much and overnight with a vote, but I guess that's the way things happen. But the impact for us, for the U.S. and the geopolitics are some are sort of just tactical annoyance. Like things are just going to have to be renegotiated because we have all these sort of intelligence sharing and efforts on military and intelligence and diplomatic efforts that are aligned with the EU. That's annoying. It's not like they can't be overcome. It's just going to be annoying for the U.S. But I think there's something bigger that makes me nervous about Brexit. And that is, you know, Brexit basically, you know, they voted to leave based on a number of assumptions that weren't true. And one of them was that nothing good has ever come out of Brussels. And I think that's just actually factually not true. I mean, if you think about the capacity of the U.S. to have an aligned European partner in threats that know no borders, Brussels has actually been remarkably helpful in this regard. And I think this notion that nothing good came out of Brussels may be, even if Britain can work around some of the near-term challenges on the economic issues with Brexit, I think that's going to have a long-term impact for our relations. And the fact that, you know, a united Europe is generally better for mankind than a divided one.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
This time of year, I always like to share a quote I love from John Adams about July 4th, which he wrote in a letter to Abigail. I believe that this day will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be celebrated by pomp and parade with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other. Happy July 4th, everyone.
Dahlia Lithwick.
Oh my God, I sound so cranky next to Rich, but I'm going to say how dispirited I was that almost unnoticed this week, the Supreme Court handed down an 8-0 vote to vacate the conviction of Bob McDonnell, former Virginia governor, for federal corruption under the perplexing theory that it can't really be corruption if everyone does it, and moreover, that everybody takes bribes. It really only matters how you use them. It just seems to me that in a moment of unparalleled anxiety about elite self-dealing institutions, the court made a whopper of a mistake with no dissents.
Juliette Kayyem.
With all this global bad news, I'm going to bring it home. It's this time of the each summer that I realize there's two kinds of parenting. One is the kind where you have all kids, one camp, and for 8 weeks. The other is parents like me who cater to the whims of your children and don't start work every day till about 10 a.m. So as we enter the throes of summer as a parent who finds summer a couple weeks too long, I applaud and bow to those who can keep it together.
For my rant, related to what Dahlia said, Bill Clinton had a meeting with Attorney General Loretta Lynch this week, an apparently impromptu meeting on the tarmac at the airport in Phoenix. And it's giving us another one of these exhausting Clinton stories in which something was done that you can't prove was untoward. Maybe it was just a social visit, like Loretta Lynch said. Maybe when Goldman Sachs paid Hillary Clinton $675,000 to give three speeches, it was just because they thought she would be really interesting. Maybe when you had staffers at the State Department also being paid by private firms at the same time they were serving as top staff to Hillary Clinton, that had no untoward effects. I think this is something that people put up with during Bill Clinton's administration in the 1990s because things were going really well for everyone. And you didn't have people worrying about whether the economic fortunes that their and other ordinary families were facing that were not very good had to do with self-dealing by elites. I think that the casual attitude that the Clintons have toward appearances of impropriety is really not cute right now the way things are in the world. And I worry because a lot of people are going to be voting for Hillary Clinton because she looks like the last defender of important institutions that Donald Trump would tear down and that populists from the left would also tear down. I worry that if things go badly during her administration, it will further discredit elite institutions that we really need to maintain stability in this world. I'm really scared about that. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Dahlia Lithwick, and Juliet Kayem. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Ashleen Knutson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.